ちは。ストのシオンです。
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Solo on Sono. Agonite presents Solo on Sono, my apologies. This is your solo host, Chris Luciantonio, and despite the large gap between episodes of these, I am still committed to crawling through the entire Sono filmography and offer my very weak-minded opinion on them. Just to remind everybody, the series was born out of quarantine boredom, and as things around my area have been getting closer and closer to semi-normal, the impulse to do this series has been dissipating a bit, but I'm still committed. Like, this will be a dedicated side series on the feed, mostly because COVID-19 or not, my admiration for Sono films and my want to talk about them, like, there is nothing that could take that away from me. And thank God the man was so prolific, because I have a bevy of films to do. And you will see this series continuing for, I don't want to say years. I would hope that I would be able to get through his filmography by the end of the year. But yeah, content galore. So with that in mind, let's continue our trek through the filmography of Sono. If you recall, on the first edition of this episode of this series, on the first episode, we took a look at Balloon Club afterwards, an existential Gen X crisis film involving a group of ballooning enthusiasts, and how the death of one of them really affects how they see each other and their worldview in general. And in the second episode, I watched and we talked about The Virgin Psychics, which is Sono being a horny old man. Yeah. I'm kind of underselling it for a bit, but it's a really weird film, but it's really enjoyable once you get past the sheer horniness of it all. So with that in mind, let's get on to the film that we will be discussing for this episode. As you recall, at the end of every episode, we use a random number generator to select the next film in his filmography for me to talk about. And last episode, it was decided on 2005's Hazard. So let's get on with that.
Excuse me. You see this piece of bread?
Yeah.
Yeah, one of my boys gonna take that for free, okay?
As is tradition, here is a little synopsis. A Japanese university student, Shin, as played by Joe Odagiri, becomes enamored with New York City after finding a book in his school library warning of how dangerous the city is for Japanese immigrants. With a fatalist mindset and no prospects in his home country, he eagerly transplants himself to the Big Apple and immediately finds the trouble he seeks. Guided by Lee, Jai West, and Takeda, Motoki Fukami, assimilated troublemakers with an equal death wish, they live a brief but dangerous existence of crime and freedom before it all comes crashing down on them. So this is Sono's film that he made in 2005, a big year for him. The mid-2000s were really big for him just in general, because at the same year, Into a Dream, Noriko's Dinner Table, and I think Strange Circus all came out the same year. With this film, it's his first to take place outside of Japan, and that's been like a fun like thread throughout his entire career, is that he's always been threatening to make another film set in America or somewhere else outside of Japan. If you can remember, for the longest time, he was the selected director to make that Lords of Chaos film. It's a film about the Norwegian black death metal church burnings and that whole community of, you know, Varvikernes and Euronymous and that whole murder. And oh yeah, it went to Jonas Åkerlund. So yeah, like he was the one who for the longest time selected to make that film. And then inevitably what happened was I think because he couldn't get a Japanese crew, because he couldn't get a dedicated Japanese crew for the production, as well as him butting heads with the producers, he eventually left that project. And since then, there's always been talk about his English language debut. Just a weird kind of thing to want from him. I know just this year, Koreeda made his English language debut, French language debut, I think. Yeah, I think. Let me just check that. I don't want to, like, be caught in a weird bit of misinformation. Yeah, The Truth. It's his latest film that is both in French and English, so I cleared that up for you. And Hazard takes place in New York City, and it's shot on the streets of New York City, and obviously it has a lot of English-speaking characters. Zhai West, Lee, he is bilingual, and he swaps back and forth between English and Japanese to communicate with Shin, who is completely, completely only speaks in the Japanese language. And Takeda is kind of in between the two of them. But speaking on this, his English language debut is going to be like apparently Prisoners of the Ghostland, that Nicolas Cage film. That's the one that's still touted as still happening, despite, you know, COVID-19 and everything, so we'll see how that goes. But Hazard is his first kind of flirting with American culture, American ideals and that perspective. And to his credit, it's actually quite revealing. So the film takes place in 2005. It was shot in 2005. And what's so fascinating about it is that rather than looking at the obvious kind of influence on this era, which would be 9/11, because, you know, it takes place in New York City, specifically around Harlem, I think, where most of the film takes place, you would think that there'd be a degree, like only 4 years after the event itself, there'd be some kind of like fallout or feeling of that disaster in the way he shoots. But because he's a Japanese filmmaker, it doesn't really cross his mind. It's so strange because he's dealing with three Japanese characters as his main cast. He takes a post-bubble burst perspective on their fatalistic adventures in New York City and their excessive want for destruction and crime. It's kind of telling how Sono frames it that way, because it's suggesting that this event was so monumental in the consciousness of, like, the Japanese people, you know, Japanese people, if we want to consider that they have a collective identity, that no matter the setting you put them in, they seek out, like, this kind of coping mechanism. Like, it's still influencing them, like, years afterward. And the way it influences them is to essentially live with no rules. Like, Shinichi, like, the main character, he's, like, a dropout from a Japanese university, which I believe is supposed to be prestigious, and all he really wants is a hazardous lifestyle. He completely removes himself from his country, goes to New York City because he heard that it's quite dangerous, that it's hazardous. Like, that's like a common, like, running joke, is that his English isn't great, and so as soon as he arrives in New York City, he just keeps asking, like, taxi cab drivers, people on the subway, of how do I get to Hazard? Where is Hazard? He wants danger. He wants excitement. And it's never really understood why his character is written this way. It seems that, like, he just a 20-something in a dead-end position at a university who doesn't, like, because of the post, like, the bubble burst, he doesn't think that he has much of a future. He's willing to just take on danger, like, head on. And he finds two soulmates in the form of Lee and Takeda, who have been living this kind of freewheeling, crime-laden, dangerous lifestyle for years, since they got to New York City from Japan. And it creates this interesting dynamic where they're showing Shin this American experience from what they've experienced themselves. And it's very skewed toward excess, it's very skewed towards anarchy, and it really colors Shin's outlook to wherein he thinks that, like, the American dream is nothing but what I've already said, like danger, destruction, anarchy, living every day like it is your last. It's a bit of a, in that way, it's a bit of a YOLO film. That's a running joke from our episode on Ikaru, if you don't know. And yeah, it counteracts their fatalist mindsets with this really gritty portrayal of New York. And I mean, yeah, obviously it's not hard to portray New York in such a gritty style, especially in like the mid-2000s when it was it like if you can recall from that era, like it had a lot of problems at the time, especially with 9/11 occurring just 4 years earlier and the mass cleanup and reconstruction that went along with clearing up Ground Zero and all that. It was not doing well, and Sono really tries to capture that grime, that like bottom of society mess that his characters are reveling in. What's so fascinating, and speaking of like Sono, how he captures things in this film, it's a really strange departure from his usual cinematography style. Because if I recall correctly, did he serve as his own cinematographer? No, he didn't. It was Hiro Yanagida. So what's so interesting about this film is just in watching it, you kind of learn that Sono obviously did not have shooting permits. And he was not really allowed to be shooting on these New York City streets in the manner that he was. It's almost like a callback to his early 90s and his early 90s and late 80s films, wherein he was completely independent and did not even bother to look up how to get a shooting permit for these locations for like his film, and he just shot on the street. And in New York, and like in this on the streets of New York, it's that same kind of guerrilla filmmaking kind of style. Because while these scenes are playing out on the streets, if you were to just like look past the characters, you notice that all of the sidewalk traffic that's normally, on New York, just kind of stops and stares at the main characters. Like everyone just wants to watch Sono make this film. And it makes for some really strange scenes wherein our main characters are like just screaming about their crime plans of the heist that they're going to do, just being as foul and gruff as possible. And there's all just these like New Yorkers acting like tourists, just gawking at the film production. And it's a weird kind of look, and it doesn't detract from the film. In fact, it makes it more fascinating. But it's just a weird thing to kind of zero in on, because you can't ignore it once you see it, and you just kind of realize, like, oh, Sono had absolutely no permission to be here, and as soon as this scene wrapped, they probably just ran away and found the next shooting location. Of course, that's just speculation. Maybe he got permission to make this film on the streets of New York, but based on the reaction from the public, I don't know if they ever attempted to close off a film set. And what helps with that, circling back to cinematography, unlike his previous films, this is almost exclusively shot with handheld. And it's these long handheld tracking shots. It helps a lot because it helps a lot with like the action of the film, because there are like muggings, store robberies, a lot of kind of like frenetic scenes that need like a frenetic cinematographer. And for those scenes, it's really kind of jarring because it's these re like all these scenes are constructed out of these really fast whip pans and awkward handheld that is really trying to keep up with the action. And when you have these three characters of Shin, Takeda, and Lee, who are like really excitable, who are just jumping off the walls with energy and overacting like charisma, it's so hard to keep track of them. And that's why the film just kind of feels like so different from any other of Sono's films. It's just strange. To really contrast this with his earlier art house films, in which he was a big fan of Steadicam and letting scenes breathe and rest and getting a feel for them. When he hits the 2000s, he really starts to experiment with digital and the freedom that digital gives him. This film is no exception, because it is so, it's so frenetic. It like really kind of gets into you and pushes you along, because it's all over the place, and a lot of that comes from the actors. The cast is phenomenal, frankly, especially Zhai West. Zhai West as Lee is this, just exerts so much personality and energy in every scene. Part of it is, like, his character is a, he sells speedballs, he's a drug dealer, and he owns this, like, ice cream company, wherein, like, it's so stupid when you say it out loud, but all of his ice cream trucks are loaded up with speedballs, and that's what they're selling to the people of New York, is that this ice cream truck comes by and gives you drugs. And the implication is that he is also high out of his mind constantly, and it's what fuels his kind of fatalist lifestyle, and the reason why he's so willing to put himself and his friends into danger, and at the moment's notice just go into a convenience store, pull out his trusty shotgun, because these kids are always strapped, and just go for it. Just try and stick up an entire convenience store and see how it goes. Obviously, that leads to his downfall later on. His careless lifestyle, and part of the plot is his drug empire and its connection with the police, and he burns that bridge pretty early on because he's just a belligerent kind of person, and he doesn't know how to jump through the hoops that the police want him to. So, yeah, and the performance by Zhai West is incredible. Like, he gave Sono everything. Like, there is not a single scene where he is not giving it his all, where he is not trying his hardest. He is not, like, embodying this character and embodying that anarchist mindset, that, like, devil-may-care attitude. And it's wonderful. It is completely entertaining, and it gives the film such a, like, a nice counterpoint to Shin, who is this, like, Shin and Takeda, who are both kind of, like, reserved and going along with the ride, because they also want to experience this kind of freedom, this kind of fatalist mindset. And yeah, like, Lee is, like, the anchor of this film. Zhai West is the reason why you watch this movie, because he is just so good in this. It's a bit of, like, a try-hard kind of overacting performance, but he just exerts so much personality. Like, I don't know how you could, like, write that off. Yeah, so, like, a lot of the film, as we were saying, because this is a Japanese production that takes place in New York City, is that, like, it's completely bilingual. Like, it's peppered throughout with it jumps back and forth between Japanese and English depending on the scenario, and some Mandarin, because part of Lee's drug operation is coordinating with the triad in New York City. It's a whole plot point that doesn't really go anywhere, so it doesn't really matter. So much of the film is Sono kind of enjoying this disconnect between the sleepy but restless Japan that Shin was living in, wherein there's no kind of hope for a future after the bubble burst, and there's no kind of, like, reason to stick around, because not only is it not granting you a future, it's also, in Sono's kind of, like, fatalistic, cynical mindset, it's also not granting you any kind of out. There's no hope for you either to live or to die. So, and that's why you contrast it with New York City, where in Sono's mind, your life is at danger at every street corner. And rather than playing this kind of, like, moralistic tale of Shin should be much more appreciative of his life in Japan and learn from this experience of almost dying several times through his connection with Lee and Takeda. The film kind of plays it like he was just excited to live for once in his life. It, like, through these really tight, long-handled scenes and, like, this dizzying intimacy that we have to these characters, we really kind of learn much more about them than just their simple death drive. And it gives the film a lot of legs where you'd expect with a film like this, it would just all be anarchy throughout and just this kind of, like, really cynical, this really kind of cynical Death Wish kind of Gen X cynicism. But these characters are much more interesting than that. One of my favorite details is Shin obviously is not bilingual. His English is very poor, and he only really converses through Takeda and Lee, who know some English. And one of my favorite touches, which is a very Sono kind of trope, is the way that Lee teaches Shin English is through poetry. If you've followed the series or follow Sono, you know that he was a poet before he was a filmmaker. Still is a poet after being a filmmaker. And he loves putting poetry in his films. Either having a character be a poet or just using it as exposition or narration. He loves putting poetry in his films. And in this film, Shin learns English by studying Walt Whitman poems. And it's a really, really, like, it's funny in like a Sono way, because it just feels like he couldn't help himself and he just really wanted to get that detail in. But it also gives this kind of depth to Lee and to Shin, in that they aren't these belligerent assholes who are just going onto the streets of New York and randomly murdering and robbing people, mugging them, and dealing drugs just because they want to. It's like there is some kind of poetic depth to them. We don't really see it because so much of the film is just enjoying in their insanity and their fatalistic lifestyle. But you know, it's there. It doesn't really come to the forefront too often. But I think why a lot of people kind of write this film off is because the characters are kind of one dimensional, and I just don't see that. Like I really do think that, given the context of when this film takes place and their backstory of being these run-down Japanese immigrants who have no prospects, it completely makes sense that they are these belligerent anarchist assholes who are just tearing up the streets of New York and trying to have the most fun they can before they inevitably, like, all their actions come back at them. So yeah, if you have not been able to tell by how many times I've said, like, cynical, nihilistic, fatalist, these three are ideal Sono protagonists who have no like concept of the traditional family lifestyle, who have no concept of the good citizen of Japan who is supposed to, you know, do well in school, get a salaryman job, have a family, and live, and like propagate the nation that way. These three are completely disconnected from that whole lifestyle, that whole that whole mindset, and it makes them perfect Sono protagonists because that is just like the character that he finds so fascinating. It's I've never really talked about it before, but I've always found it so interesting that Sono himself, like, being, I think at the time of this film, he was still, like, in his late 30s, early 40s, that he has, like, his thumb on the pulse of the youth, even with that, like, large age gap. He seems to really get their emotional crisis, their existential crisis that the teens, millennials, Gen Xers, Gen Zers, Zetters, are going through. And it really gives a lot of his films like this cynical, nihilistic edge, but it shows that he is like attempting to understand the younger generation, mostly because it's so weird how he's so connected with youth films and portrayals of youth, because like the man is old. Like he's like in his he's like 56 or something now. Hold on, let me check that because I haven't really checked how old he is in a while. 58. He's almost 60 years old. Jesus Christ. But yeah, he has an incredibly sympathetic portrayal a depiction of their existential crises. Like these three characters who are like just awful, awful people. They are pushing drugs on they're pushing drugs on people at their wits' end. They are indiscriminately mugging and killing people in some cases, and they just have a want for destruction and anarchy, but they come across as very sympathetic, and that speaks both to the power of Sona's writing ability and to the power of the context in which he sets his film. It's possible that if you don't really know a lot about the post-bubble mindset and how bleak things felt in that lost decade of the 90s and into the early 2000s before their economy got back on track, a lot of their actions seem really bizarre and belligerent and strange. But if you have that kind of context, if you're like given that kind of context for them, it makes a lot more sense. So yeah, I'm not sure what else to say about Hazard. That's the interesting thing is that it's a really interesting work, but given where it was filmed, why it was made, and what it's trying to say about these Gen X or Gen Z kids and their position in life. But it's also so self-contained that it's hard to relate to the rest of his filmography. Yes, like the poetry, the fatalistic mindset, and the quick escalation of violence, and the attempts to relate that violence to some kind of poetic understanding. Yet, yes, it's all present here, but you can't really see the connecting threads between the rest of his films. This is like an oddity in it, because it honestly feels more like a Mike film. Mike famously made these gritty street dramas about criminals and their day-to-day fatalistic dealings, and it almost feels like he's trying to emulate that. Sona was trying to emulate that kind of film, because if you compare this to the films that he made the same year, like Strange Circus, Noriko's Dinner Table, and Into a Dream. Those have so much substance to them. There is so much to pick apart and peer into, and they are yes, all three of those films are very different, but you can kind of see where they connect. Hazard is this kind of like dropped point in the Sono filmography that's not really talked a lot about, and it's kind of like just it's there, but no one really wants to go further into it, like, 'cause it's loud, it's obstructing, and a lot of people don't think it's saying a lot. But I'm a fan. I think this has its place. And just like being shot guerrilla style in New York City, and from what I'm saying, the film came out in 2005, but it was shot in like 2002, so only a year after 9/11 occurred was Sono prowling the streets of New York City, filming this existential teen drama, this teen crime drama, and yeah, it's really interesting. It's really fascinating. I would say watch it. I will say be wary of it because while it doesn't really apply to like those tired American crime cliches, that's a point from Mark Schilling's review in the Japan Times, which I agree with. He kind of, in that same review, he also calls out its racism, and yeah, that's kind of the deal. There are, this is New York City, there are black characters, and yeah, Sono didn't handle that one well. But regardless, I think it's a worthy experiment, and it's absolutely worth your time if you were to track it down and watch it. I think the entire thing's on YouTube. Unlike now, Balloon Club afterwards. I think after that episode I said, hey, if you want to check this out, the entire thing's on YouTube, and it was taken down for copyright or something. So while you still can, go check out Hazard on YouTube. Okay. So that concludes my miniature ramble on Hazard. Very undisciplined, very off the top of the dome, and probably terrible. But, you know, hope you liked it. And as is tradition, I am now going to go to the selection process. Just a website. I have all the films of Sona which I haven't talked about yet. And here we go. So this will determine what I talk about next. So I'm going to really theatrically push the button to determine it, and all right. So it looks like we will be talking about Make the Last Star. Wait, no, that's not the right title. Oh, Jesus, I screwed this one up. it's Make the Last Wish, not Make the Last Star. This is a really weird one. I don't want to say too much about it. Again, this isn't available on YouTube, so before that episode comes out, if you want to go check that out, go ahead. This is a really weird one. I don't know what to say about it. I believe it's about Avril Lavigne. Canadian pop singer Avril Lavigne, to an extent. Well then, that'll be fun when I get around to it. Make sure to follow us at Egg of Night Podcast, both on Facebook and on Twitter, at Egg of Night. And as kind of like a side to this series, I've also started a Twitter account where I've been posting screen grabs and kind of content related to Sion Sono. That's at Sion Film at Twitter. If you search for a Sion Sono film, you'll be able to find it pretty easily. Take care, stay inside, wear your mask, wash your hands, all that good stuff, and see you next time for more Sono fun.